Welcome to Bigfoot
and the Bunny.
This is a couple's journey into the mysterious,
the unknown,
and the paranormal. I'm your host, Chris Carr.
And I'm your host, Kristen Johnson.
Together, we are Bigfoot and the Bunny.
Right on. Welcome to Bigfoot and the Bunny. I'm Chris Carr.
And I'm Kristen Johnson.
And we are very lucky tonight. We have a very special guest who decided here last minute to come in.
Thank you for listening to another episode.
Yes, thank you so much.
Our very good friend, Nathaniel J. Gillis, is with us tonight.
Yes.
Hello, Nathaniel. How are you doing, buddy?
Doing good, guys. I am so happy to rejoin some of my favorite people in the world.
Thank you.
I missed
you guys, and I'm excited about just being here again. Really is an excitement for me.
Thank you, that was a short intro. Sorry I didn't give you a minute. I really didn't plan on talking about much. Usually I kind of chart these things out, but you said, what the hell? Let's just get right into it, you know?
Wing it.
That'll work. Let's do it.
How you been? What have you been up to? It's been a little while since you've been on, and we did the Dark Horse Paranormal Podcast, Demonology Volume 1, which is doing really good. I got just a ton of downloads of this. People are liking it. I'm getting great feedback. And what have you been up to, man?
I have been just all kinds of things, honestly. It's been a ride for me. I mean, I've just been researching, reading academic papers, and trying to put this tapestry of Nephilim, ghosts, possession, all of this together so that we can, dig deeper into this subject and actually get a tangible answer, not just the descriptions, but actual definition and modus operandi. And I think that I'm getting closer. I'm not going to say I have it all together, but thankfully the scholars that I have been reading have really sewn together a major portion of this for me.
That's great. It's great to hear.
Awesome. I think your mic is bouncing around a little bit there. There you go. So not to make you paranoid. That something's bouncing around. One of us is.
It's not mine.
I don't know. It could be me.
It's probably me.
Who did it? I saw you reach for the cord. But anyways. Mm-hmm. We were having a good conversation. We were talking about serial killers and demonic possession.
Yes, we were.
Things kind of evil, kind of, which is a really fun thing to do on a Monday night, by the way. I had a great time. Thank you.
That was a blast.
Conversation.
Who would have thought that would have happened at that time? You know, hey, how you doing? Next thing you know, 2 hours later, we
dug deep. I like this conversation.
Yeah, the psychology and both of us. I mean, he would bring up a point, and I would sit there in unholy awe, just, oh my God, and vice versa. It was just awesome. I really enjoyed
it. It's like, am I keeping you up? I'm like, I'm not that old.
Then
you would say, hey, are you walking around like I am, pacing around, thinking about this stuff? I was like, no, I'm sitting down, man. I'm old.
You're like, hold on, I stood up too fast. I got dizzy. Hold on a minute.
Right. A little life alert.
OnStar.
I'm falling and I can't get up.
No doubt. Yeah, I enjoyed it. And like I said, you guys are some of my favorite people in the world. And again, you know, it's always an honor to be with you guys.
Back at you, man. We really appreciate you coming on again.
Yes, thank you.
Love the conversation because I love what you're doing. You know, you're bringing some new perspectives to the paranormal and things that haven't been heard before and drawing, you know, correlations and lines to things that people just aren't talking about. And they should be.
They should be. Yes, sir. It's, you know, again, the possession phenomenon, I think that in the 21st century, it's going to be redefined and repositioned and really restored to what it meant to those who wrote about it in biblical antiquity, ancient Sumer, and Mesopotamia. So it's really, I'm saying the same thing they did back in the day, but I'm just saying it to people who've never really heard it before. And once we get that out in the open, it's going to add pieces of the puzzle to really show us what has been going on for millennia and what they're after. Because again, this possession thing is not just it's not just going to feed the fancies of religious pop culture. It's a real thing. They're after real tangible material, and essentially possession's a test run for the future. And I think that if we can understand that, quantify it accurately, it's going to eclipse even the movies, even the darkest, most sinister descriptions of what we've seen and know this to be. It's far larger, it's deeper, and it's global. And we will be, in my mind, I'm not trying to be dark and negative, but it will be a fight for our existence. And
my goodness,
it's a troubling thing, but we have to know about it because, God said my people are killed because of their lack of knowledge. And so knowledge is a weapon. And unless we first weaponize our curiosity, we'll never access all the other weapons that are at our disposal.
Wow.
Right on.
Right on.
I'm sorry. That mic noise, Chris. I think maybe it's the fan. It
might be.
Something. It's making a lot of noise.
Pardon me.
I'm sorry.
You all pardoned.
Thank you, sir.
So why do you think this is? Do you think it's getting worse? Do you think things are growing?
In a way, I think that.
Was that it?
Yeah, sounds like it.
Yeah, no, it's quiet.
Well, if I melt, I melt.
I'm already melting.
Yeah, I'm melting away here. So.
I'm going to look like a candle real quick.
I'm very sorry.
I
did a quick check, but I didn't pick up on that. That was the fan, I think, just making noise on your mic.
Thank you.
Apologize.
I apologize to everyone.
Yeah, all right. So they're doing the same thing, and many, many things that they're doing and how they're accessing us, their modus operandi, in many cases, it's both symbolic, symbiotic, and actually happening. So it's not just allegory, it's not just symbolism, and they'll employ that in what they're doing in their rituals and their victimology, but it's bigger than that. When I was talking to you, Chris, earlier in the week, we had discussed some of the different cases of possession and how that these entities would employ symbolism, even on the bodies, if not in the bodies, on the homes, in the homes, using symbolism in terms of crosses upside down, melting the fingers of the Virgin Mary. And one of the things that I will stress in this discipline is that these are not random acts. They're strategically placed within the peripheral vision of the witness. If you follow the directors and producers and writers of horror, they'll teach. I watched one lecture on it where he was a horror writer, and he explained how it is that if when you watch a movie that's scary, that the actual entity, the ghost or the murder or the bloody crime scene, it's always within a certain portion of your vision. It's designed to be that way because it's designed. It's not to the right or to the left. It's right, right where it wants to be, because that's at that point, it has your full attention. It's not an accident. And so when we deal with possession cases and hauntings and EVPs, and we think, okay, these are all accidents, they're not. In many cases, they are manipulating the biological evolution of humanity to a molecular level to make sure you do understand that what it's saying and you heard it or that you saw it. And so when we see shadow people in our peripheral vision, that's not an accident. It wanted you to see it. And so these entities at the very least are maybe 10, but at the very least are 30 seconds ahead of time. Their understanding of time is at least to the point where they know where you're going to look and when you're going to look.
Right.
Does it make sense?
Right.
And then they manifest.
I totally agree with that. I've always felt like they do have a different idea of what time is than we do. You know, like almost there is no sort of time. And I'm saying just entities, you know, when I'm talking about spirits.
Right.
They just seem to have a different view. They have different perceptions than we have. Mm-hmm. You know, I always say we're limited by our five senses, you know, and that's what makes up our perception. I don't think they have those same limitations.
Right.
So something can kind of like say, all right, yeah, I'm going to be right here. And just when you walk into that room, you're going to walk by.
Welcome home, Chris.
Right.
Yeah, right.
We're fairly haunted people, as you know. So like we kind of experience.
Where you been? I fed the dogs. Water the plants for you.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. We need them to start doing our chores. Yeah, we were talking about that. Like, you know, can you start doing the dishes or something?
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Could you pick up the vacuum sometime, you know?
Clean the litter box.
You know what I mean? Like, cut the grass for me, then we'll talk.
But the things we're talking about are much darker, you know, and we get into the concept of serial killers and why they would have the obsessions that they do. Mm-hmm. And possession, I mean, we are talking about something else entirely. We're not talking about Casper here.
No.
Oh, God, no. No, we're dealing with a measure of necromancy where we have beings, entities, living people, souls that seek not just the embodiment, but they have cravings that cannot be filled where they are. So it's the hunger. I got to eat, but I can't. It's weird. It's a very, and this is some research that I'm just now getting into that deals with scarification and the birthing rituals found in Mesopotamian and Sumer and how much it mirrors possession in modernity. And like I said before, it's not just give me a social skin. I don't want just an epidermal essence, but these entities want the epidermal essence because they will use it as a way of a weapon. This is chilling. And so they'll embody someone, test that host out in anticipation of embodying them once again. And that could be before or after death.
Well, it's really interesting, Nathaniel.
I know we talked about these spirits being more like spirits rather than something that hadn't been human at one time.
Yeah.
An unclean spirit, you know, as mentioned in the Bible. Yeah. Do you think they miss it? Do they miss the life existence, and maybe this goes back to more barbaric ways.
Oh, you know, yeah.
When people were just more cruel to each other. Not that we're not cruel today. I mean, you know, you look at your news feed on Facebook and you'll see cruelty in all sorts of ways. Mm-hmm. But this is modern day cruelty, which is, you know, a drop in a bucket compared to civilizations past, where they're beheading people in, you know, and Aztec days. Yeah.
The Mayans.
Yeah. You know, watching the head roll down the stairs and, you know, those pyramids.
Yeah. I mean, if we put their social and religious rituals into the context of modernity, it would literally give us PTSD. I mean, it would really mess with us psychologically. And yet they were so immune to it. Like I was talking to my father the other day, you know, just mentioning, and he's a scholar in his own right in theology, and just mentioning to him some of the literature I was reading, and I came across a passage. It was what's called commentary on the Bible character Laban in the Old Testament, and how that he had created what are called teraphim, and that's it's a plural. We thought when I grew up that it was just the figurines; they were idols. Mm-hmm. That's what thought they were, and yet it wasn't. That's not what Yahweh really had an issue with. That was the primary issue. The secondary issue that really got to the root of it is how they created these figurines. And I know this is going to be very, very dark, but like I said, it's better to weaponize our curiosity than to stick it in the corner and hope that it can save us one day. The teraphim was a ritual where they would go and find a firstborn boy. They would behead him.
All right.
Take his head. Put a what was it? They would scalp him. They would take the hair off his head. They put his head in the wall, and then they would put a a bar, like a metal bar or a piece of wood, and they would carve the name of an unclean spirit. A Tuma Rua, by the way, it's a deceased entity. Again, these are not deities. And he would carve that name of that entity, that unclean spirit, on the bar, put it underneath the tongue, and that head would become possessed by that entity and begin to converse. Ooh, I got chills. With Laban. And so that was the issue with idolatry in biblical antiquity. It wasn't limited to just, let me make a form of a man or an image. It was, listen, we're going to create an image to put a spirit in it. So an idol, this gets good, an idol is a form without a spirit. Let's say a body without right. a spirit. A ghost is a spirit without a body. And everything that we're wrestling with in modernity, everything from biblical antiquity, Sumer, Mesopotamia, the Akkadian text, everything up till now has been about entities who Yahweh either judged to die or they died outside of their time. And now they're wanting to return again. And that's not the beginning and end of it, but essentially that's what we're dealing with. We have to look at it in the face and say, this is what it is. That's what the data says. That's what the ancient, what are called reliefs, they teach us this. But that's where my research is at right now.
Sure. That's in the cuneiforms, in a way that the Sumerians would treat an effigy like a person. They would go through great mm-hmm. lengths to birth it, if you will, you know, to give it a soul.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah, you're right. And again, like when I was growing up, you know, anybody who listens to my interviews, you guys are well aware that I came from a Christian tradition. And so it was bred into me the assumption that, you know, I had a supremacy. There was a religious primacy over all these other religions. And we really knew what spiritual warfare is. And at the same time, even the literature that we were given, it just fell short. It waxed elementary. And so I think that once we get into the literature, especially the book I'm writing right now, and I'll be finished with it here very shortly. Once we dive into it, we're going to realize that this has been happening for millennia, and that through descriptions, these people who suffered from these entities, either in childbirth or in death, it was almost as if they had stammering lips. They could not even articulate the kind of evil that's literally, we'll get into it, literally stared them right in the face, to the point that, I got chills, that there are many pregnant women would actually lose their child in the womb because they would wake up and there would be an entity staring at them in the face.
Wow.
So my question is, are they intending for the baby to die, or was it simply a byproduct of its presence? It gets deep.
Right. That's a good question, Jim.
And that's in Mesopotamia and Sumer. And it's these texts are actually rewritten and even quoted oftentimes in the Bible. It, you know, they're not pointing forward to something we would encounter just in the future. They're going both ways and saying, listen, if you don't understand the past, you're going to be doomed to repeat it. And it's the responsibility of the demonologist to go back and through archaeology, through the literature of the day, to pull these images out and project them upon the canvas of the future so that people in my generation don't have to suffer the same way they did.
Jeepers.
Sure. Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit about serial killers, but you also have to wonder about, you know, the people who have brought about genocides and mass murder.
Correct.
You know?
Correct.
We talked about Arthur Shawcross, for example, who actually claimed to be possessed.
Yeah.
Yeah, he thought he was possessed by, according to, I think it's murderpedia.org, he believed that the spirit of a 13th century cannibal, Aramis, possessed his body. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly, but Aramis possessed his body and drove him to rape, murder, and cannibalism. In 1988, this guy was released from prison, having served 15 years for the sadistic murder of two children in Watertown. Mm-hmm. Out on parole, he was sent to Rochester to live after residents in two other communities objected to his presence. Right about then, Aramis, mm-hmm. or whoever that was, came back to possess him, and he went on a 20-month murder spree. And he was a cannibal. Rapist. He also blamed his mother's spirit, his dead mother's spirit. Apparently, his mother enjoyed ramming broomsticks, quite frankly, up his ass when he was a boy. You know,
that's horrible. So
yeah, that's what it says here. I'm just reading from Murderpedia.
Yeah, but, it's
basically having been trauma like that would make anybody, you know, really screwed up on the head.
Yeah,
and right there maybe, with the possession.
But maybe not. I don't know. I mean, he claims he was possessed.
Right.
Yeah. It's what's most chilling for me when I read into the serial killer psychopathology, it's they all fall under certain circumstances and different characteristics that make them who they are. And a lot of times when I begin to do like a case study, or when I'm even just floating around on YouTube and I see something like My Ghost Story, I always look at these experiences as a crime scene, because it's not a victimless thing when there's a malevolent haunting. And so my next step in my research, once I get this book published, is to look at what's called the corpus linguistics of these entities, how they talk and the terms that are in many cases antiquated. They're old. And even in the Perrin case in Harrisville, Rhode Island, when the mother, she began to speak differently. She went out and got a new dress, respectively. You know, it's the parents are awesome people. I hope to meet them one day, hopefully. But, you know.
I'm sure you will. You'll meet Andrea.
Yeah. You can start to hear her language change. According to, watch this, the dress matched the time frame the language was used. So, I don't know how Beelzebub would want to wear a dress and have his vocabulary limited to one portion of history. What would be the purpose, you know? The serial killer pathology, it's a lot like possession. And I began to really dig into that when I saw Dennis Rader, which we can get back onto him, or we can, you know, go back and forth between these two. But Dennis Rader, in his trial, he gave a testimony, and he was going through some just a gross description, oh my God, of his crimes and how he committed them. And but his last victim was the little girl, she was a young, but she wasn't a little girl, which he took her downstairs to the basement, and, you know, it happened. But they asked him a weird, this is crazy. They said, now what position was she in when you left her body? And most people, at least in my mind, would actually tell them what position he was in, right? That's the answer to the question. Why would you answer the question, you know, differently? If you watch him, he puts both hands behind his back and acts like he's the girl, not the serial killer.
Right. And just so our listeners know, Rader was known as the BTK killer. He gave himself that name, which was bind, torture, and kill.
Correct.
He bound his victims. Just fun to throw that in there.
Yeah. So again, what position were you in? What position was she in? So in order for him to get a better understanding, again, this gets into the pathology. Pathology is the nature of a disease, how it mutates. That's why I use that. I use psychopathology too, but these entities are a cancer, essentially. The way he thought about the victim, the way he thought about the actual act, was that he did not see himself through his eyes. In order for him to remember and gather what happened, how it happened, when it happened, everything, he had to literally put his physical body in the same shape that she was in so that he could see himself through her. And that's how he answered the question.
Wow.
All right. He saw himself both as a killer and a victim.
Yes. And that is, again, the pathology and victimology of possessing entities. Fritz Kramer, again, when he went to Haiti and in Africa and all these different, I mean, you know, Haiti in general. But he went there and the local said, and it really confused him. And I remember I underlined it and highlighted it. And I circled it and highlighted it and wrote it down, took a picture, looked it up on my phone, screenshot. I could not get it out of my mind because they said, we do not go to see the possessed person because we want to see him. We want to go see him because we want to be seen by him.
Wow.
So there's a duality here that has to be researched. It's not enough for me to commit a crime if there's not someone to see it. And most often, it's the victim that has to be there. I'm going to put myself into the eyes of the victim so that I could actually see me for the way that I want to be seen. So it comes down to the insecurity and the wasting away. But again, it's possession.
It's ritual, though. It's ritual, what you're talking about.
Absolutely.
So it's, you know, and being ritual, we're talking about doing something for some other being.
An
to
offering.
Be seen by them.
Yes.
Right, offering. Exactly, exactly.
And yeah, and it's not the death of the thing. It's the torture. It's the manipulation. Again, now we're going back into the incubus and succubus. I'm going to groom you. And what's fascinating as well is it's not enough to commit these crimes in terms of sexual, you know, natures and all that stuff. It's not enough that happens. It's a complete and total possession. And in the end of the act, the victim is no longer with us, and then that particular belief system that rests upon the shoulders of these people will begin to determine the next steps, just like it determined the next steps before. And that would be cut a piece of, sometimes it's flesh, sometimes it's a piece of clothing, it's a license, it's an earring, and those are trophies.
The trophies, right.
All right, the things they collect.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah, the collecting
behavior seen in today's serial killers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really, it's disturbing, but someone has to look into this because we can't, you know, there are tools, there are things that we can do and research and relearn and reintroduce it to my, there's things that we can do to fight this. But before we can fight, we have to understand the enemy and entities. We can't just go off of descriptions anymore. Those descriptions are the footnotes that can lead us to the actual book that these entities are writing.
Right.
Rage Against the Machine said, know your enemy, right?
I love Rage.
That's a great song.
Yeah. So, go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm just trying to remember his name. Is it David Berkowitz? He said like almost the same thing. Like he was possessed by, or the neighbor's dog told him to do all that. Isn't that Son of Sam, I believe? Wonderful. He also said that too, that yeah. He was possessed.
It's literally like someone stepping into a room and doing something that's ritual based. Again, these rituals did not come to them by, you know, someone opening up a, a fortune cookie. Like this is some very strategic stuff. And then once the act is actually performed, it's like they step out of it and ask themselves, what just happened? And so what's most interesting to me, again, is how that the psychology behind this, how the person was molded prior to the act. In other words, again, I'm going to create an avoiding you, and I'm going to step in and see how far I can go. So like Dr. Jerry Marzinski's work, we'll talk about how he, you know, he dealt with people. He's in the mental health industry and, mm-hmm. You know, how people would hear voices and the voices would tell them to do something. And I think, again, that's a test run. First of all, you got to hear me. Second of all, you have to acknowledge it. And then the third thing is, you, those two are done. Now here's the third progression. Are you going to do what I tell you to do? And so the possession aspect of it, again, in my mind, is that, as far as I can tell, it's a test run to what's coming. It's I want skin again. The epidermal essence plays a big role in this. And in my work right now, there are at least just, well, two kinds of entities that we're dealing with. Now, the demonology in ancient Mesopotamia always dealt with entities that were either semi-divine, which were ancestors who were deified, right? Those are your Nephilim, by the way. Mm-hmm. Your Rephaim, they're the deceased ancestors. It's not angels that fell, it's mortals that died and went. That's an interesting.
It is. Right?
So what you have here are two groups of souls that are restless. That's what they were called. They're restless because they cannot rest. And the one entity that will possess, and this is all throughout the work of Jaime Vital and Isaac Luria, was someone whose life was taken before their time. And so they're restless. They can't sleep. There's an injustice. The blood guilt rests upon someone's shoulders. And now they're restless. They move to and fro, and they inhabit different bodies looking for the justice that they deserve. There's the second entity, is the entity that murdered the first one or displaced them in the first place.
Oh, wow.
That's an interesting thought.
Right.
We've talked about that, entities that exist and possess the bodies of, you know, people that maybe died prematurely and then they didn't die.
Yeah. Oh, right?
Maybe they're not dead. But they did die, and their soul was taken from them, or maybe it was leaving the body. Insertion of an external spirit.
Yes, sir.
And there you go.
Yes, sir. That is okay. Yeah. Again, someone who was taken before their time. This could happen through tragedy or anything like that. And I'm not saying all souls that are restless are that. There are plenty of people who experience such trauma, and you know they've transitioned, right? But I'm talking about specifically people who have a desire to be again. You know?
Right, right. I think there is a thing about that where spirits do want to live again or experience what life is. Like this is a gift. Mm. There's something to behold and these five senses, as I mentioned earlier, that is not translated, even though the perceptions are different and maybe enhanced in some ways. Maybe they're not as good in other ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's that.
You know, sex seems to be like a thing that's like a driving force in some of these serial killers and
yes.
That. Where do you think that plays a role? I mean, the two guys we were talking about definitely had sexual, sadistic tendencies that were just freaking sick.
Yeah, it's the fantasy issue here. Again, the possession case. My God, I can't get away from it. I have to be seen by someone for that fantasy to actually give meaning.
Right. I think it was a Raider that they caught. Where they left, it was Raider or Shawcross, I forget, because I was reading up on both of these
Shawcross.
Guys.
He went back.
Shawcross. And he went back to the scene. The police actually left the body.
Yeah.
It was like floating in a little creek or pond or something, and they caught him masturbating in his car.
Right
near there, like just over the bridge, like looking at where the body was.
Yeah,
they got him.
He was in the restroom, but I don't think that's true, you know. But yeah, I mean, it's a scary. I mean, I know what I'm saying is you're right. I'm saying that they kind of whitewashed
Sick.
It there.
Sick.
But to revisit the place of the crime again, it's the victimology, and that's why I think that a lot of hauntings that we go into, there are two entities you'll encounter. You'll encounter either the person who was murdered there, buried there, or the possessing entity who actually committed the crime itself. That's what I encountered in my biggest case, real not biggest in, you know, my really darkest case was the murderer was hiding from me upstairs in the closet.
Oh my gosh.
It's a possessing entity. Yeah. So
tell us a little about that. I know you worked on some cases, but we haven't, I know you can't reveal all the details.
Well, no, that was the murder. Where we might have I don't know if
we did on the podcast. Yes.
Yeah, it was a murder case where the father-in-law had possessed a girl outside of the home, who went in and just tried to kill up the entire family. And I had never had a case of that magnitude. But yeah, the entity had possessed the girl. Matter of fact, she had a male's voice coming out of her body during the act. So there, if it's possible, which it is, and I think that this it's either it has happened or it will happen, that there will be a demoniac who has both the murderer and the victim of the murder possession right in the same body at one time. Now, I think, watch this. I'm going to throw this out there, guys. And some people might say I'm crazy. I really don't care. I'm going to suggest that the reason these entities want everyone to believe they're fallen angels is because when we do hear the, I got chills. When we do hear the voice of a victim, we'll curse it to the darkness and really silence the cry. Don't talk to them. Call them. They're all fallen angels. They all lie. That's not true. They don't. And so, I think that systematic demonology, the idea of an hierarchy in terms of possessing entities and, oh, my God, it's Beelzebub. I think that's their last attempt at anonymity. Mm-hmm. They don't want to be known for who they are.
Well, what they want to be. And like stepping into roles. And I think we talked a little bit about that. Yeah. We've definitely talked about it on the show. How spirits sometimes will step into the role of something in a haunting that maybe you're getting something that says Beelzebub, or I've been called Beelzebub.
Yeah.
Different things. No, seriously. And I remember going to
Satan and Beelzebub. We played it on our show.
We did. And I remember going to a residential investigation years ago, and they had brought in an exorcist. They had done all these things. And I just had this impression. And I'm not claiming to be psychic or whatever, but I did not feel like the being was what it was claiming to be. It was like it was something that wanted to just fill that role, like kind of walk into those shoes and say, yeah, here I am.
Of course.
But it's two-faced. It's not what it's presenting itself to be at all.
Correct. It goes back into the psychology of a serial killer. It's I want to control, I want to dominate, and I want to be seen controlling and seen dominating. It's very interesting. Like when you have someone who is blind, the victimology changes because they can't see the person who's dominating. They can't hear the person who's dominating. And so there are different value systems and belief systems that these entities operate off of. But as far as I can tell, we're dealing with either entities who are ancient, and I don't think this is right, but who are either ancient in existence or are operating off of ancient beliefs. And that's why in Genesis 6, it's so important to understand who these entities were. Even in Ezekiel 13, which Chris and I had talked about earlier, Yahweh calls this belief system, this murdering, rampage-oriented necromancy, he called them soul hunters. And he cursed them. In Ezekiel 13, he said, those who hunt the souls of men, that they should fly. Not the men should fly, the souls of the men should fly. And it goes back to, it's really a reference back into Egyptian texts, where they believe that the soul, the ba'a, the soul flew like a bird out of the body when the person translated. And these entities, let's look at it again. Let's look at the similarities here. These entities, these soul harvesters, would slip into the homes and bedrooms of innocent people at nighttime. And they would take the soul into their hands, take the flesh off of the victim and sew it onto their bodies. Trophy.
Right.
Collectors.
And they created, again, let's talk about possession. They were called social skin.
Wow.
There you go.
Yahweh said this, and this has really recently captured my imagination. He said, you take the lives of the innocent to keep alive the guilty. So again, we have two entities here. One is displaced. One has dispossessed its own body. And another one has caused it. Yahweh says this. This is really what a curse that Yahweh leveled against these entities. He said, he's referring to what's called a naked soul. A naked soul is a soul that has died, and it no longer has the garment of skin. They were called naked souls. In Genesis, you see Adam and Eve, they became naked, and they saw, and what did they do? They immediately went and sewn something. And so what we're dealing with, and that's what he's referring to when he says that I will come to you, and he said, I will tear away your garment. Now, an exorcist is one who removes the spirit. That's not what Yahweh said. He said, I will rip the flesh off of your spirit. It's a whole different curse. I got chills. He said, I will rip the flesh off of you, and you will again be a naked spirit. So if, watch this, he can't rip flesh off of something that's not there.
Right.
It's like saying, I'll make you this. It's so spooky. You know, those words are chilling. They're definitely chilling. And that's what I love about you. You're able to like go back and like talk about biblical quotes that just fall right in line with
demonologist, man.
You know, what happens, you know, in our real time. And modern day.
It's happening now, and these entities exist. I know they do. And let me say this. I'm going to quote something for y'all. This is going to blow your minds. Let me find it. Now, you guys know I love anthropology.
Mm-hmm.
All right. There's an anthropologist by the name of James Frazier.
Oh, yeah.
And he's James George Frazier. Mm-hmm. Now, he's one of my favorites because he does a lot of work on mythology. I'm going to say something, and I'm going to reference my buddy Frazier here and tie these two texts together. In Ezekiel 13, if you go into the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament,
okay,
he says that they clothed themselves with external souls. Now, what does that mean? Yeah, I haven't talked to you about this one, but wait till you hear this. Oh, my God. Frazier highlights, again, you know how the Bible talks about these entities, like the Nephilim, the Rephaim? They're warriors. They're, in the Hebrew, they call them Giborim. That's not so much what they are, but it's how they've survived to this day. How do they become warriors, right? It's almost as if they're immortal. What are they doing? You know, like, how are they still living?
And talked about perceiving them as giants.
Correct.
Because they were giant in stature, in their achievements, and that kind of thing.
Yes, sir. And that was who they were prior to death. It was, you know, your deceased ancestors, your culture heroes. Now, in Apocalypse of John, it tells you that these entities, these disincarnate spirits, they went into the women. And this is in Genesis 6. That's what the Apocalypse of John is referring to here. And it says that they first appeared to these wives as their husbands. And then through the actual intercourse, at the most heightened climaxing moment, they instantaneously changed their appearance to their actual image. Why? Because there was an ancient belief that's still prevalent in certain portions of the body that whatever the woman was focused upon during the act of the climax, that her womb would create the material image of what she was looking at.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
That is classic UFO abduction.
Absolutely.
Right.
When
the
entity stared at them in the face. Ooh, don't you love Revelation? We're not left in the dark.
Absolutely. And like, how would they explain UFOs back then?
Of course.
You know, so to speak. It's not going to come across the way we talk today. It's going to be something different.
Correct. You know? Correct. And so again, that was how they believed in the Apocalypse of John. That's how they described it. A lot of people go to the Book of Enoch as if that's the tell-all. No, it's not. It gives us an understanding, a perception of an event that has traversed the entire world. Are we good on time?
Yeah, we got time. We started a little late.
Okay.
It's work on
so watch this.
This alien demon serial killer.
Yeah.
Apocalypse of John says that they begot these entities, they begot from the darkness children whose image, again, what I tell you before, right? Whatever the woman, the belief is, whatever the woman focuses on during the actual climax and act, that she will create the actual image of in her womb, right? So you have the progenitor, let's call it like this, the father, the entity, the apparition, and that which is in the womb that looks like it. Oh, God.
Ah, that's creepy, but I'm going to say it could be the mailman, too.
It could be. Little Steven has big
eyes. I can throw a little humor in that because we are getting into some deep stuff here, man.
Oh, my God.
You know?
We have to, that's why I listen to a lot of comedians and Robin Williams to keep myself, fat and cigars.
Yeah, gotta keep it up.
I love him.
Yeah.
Okay, watch this. Apocalypse of John. And I'm going to go back right to what Fraser said, and I'm going to tie it together in a way that we'll get a better understanding of what's really going on here. So the Apocalypse of John says that after the act was created, that these entities from this quote, from the darkness, it's reference to the deceased, from the darkness they begat children whose image, the skin, was made in the same appearance as their apparition. In other words, just like a father has a son and the son looks a lot like the father and you can tell the lineage and pedigree, right? You have an apparition who at the moment of intimacy changes his appearance so that the woman can create him a social skin.
Right.
Wow.
Apocalypse of John. Continue on.
Right. The Apocalypse of John said that they were copies of bodies.
Wow. That's crazy.
Here we go. Are we good? Are we okay?
We could get into blood types. You ever look into like Rh negative and that kind of thing?
Yes, sir. I'm going to read this. Okay. Remember how in Ezekiel 13, it says the social skin, it's the external soul. It's that body, right? We just talked about, okay. It's the actual image, the material, epidermal essence of what that entity looks like in the spirit. It's naked. It needs a garment again. How do I do it? Right? Watch this. What are external souls? I can get into the literature of the Bible and scholars and academic works. We could do this for hours. I'm just going to read my buddy James Fraser. Okay. This, the social skin, so long as this object, which he calls his life or soul, remains unharmed. What is that? That's the soul. That's the spirit. If it is injured, he suffers. If it is destroyed, he dies. We have seen that in the tales of the hero, your Gibborim, your warriors, as a preparation for battle, he will sometimes remove his soul from the body into other bodies to have life.
Wow.
In the Bible, we call them locusts. That's why, and again, it's the social skin. When the locust molts, you see the skin there, but it's not him.
Right, sure. Like a snake skin, you know.
So what we have are entities that will bounce in and out of social skins. Possession.
Wow.
Maybe these things drive, you know, what we see as civilization. I mean, we have to wonder, like, how do we know how to do the things we do? And are we born into this already established country and everybody's got these borders and we all got our little things, you know, it's interesting. And then you look back and it's like a certain percentage of the population, which is about 1%, that seems to control all of it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that begs, you know, conspiracy theory, you know, with legitimacy, because how is that even possible?
That's correct. That's correct. Again, it goes back to history is replete with it. And that really brings me to my point is, if we're not dealing with ancient entities, which I don't believe we are, we're dealing with entities that have ancient beliefs. And it's just like in UFO abduction, they will stare at you in the face, just like the old what are called ritual bowls in Mesopotamia, they would discuss these entities at length. And they would, the exorcist who would actually provide answers and you know, rituals, amulets against these entities. There's an entity that she's called Lamishtu. And Lamishtu can go all the way back to when the Israelites were in Egypt, and she would play the role of a midwife, but then kill the infant with her breast milk. And at first blush, anyone would think that these are just antiquated superstitions, but they're not. These are very real entities. And once we understand that and read the literature for what it's saying and break down the walls and build bridges between religions, we will have authority to say, hey, listen, we know enough now to guard ourselves in such ways, and we can. And that's where some of my research is heading later on in a year. But again,
great.
Yes, yes, sir. Yes, sir. So possession's a test run. Now, okay. So watch this. In you all right? In Mesopotamia, the entities, they were always, it was always about the children. It was always between childbirth and actual, you know, or I'm sorry, pregnancy and then childbirth. So you had your midwife who would preserve the baby in the womb. She would provide what's called the inward protection. And so the exorcist was there to provide an exterior, outward protection. Now, what we have here, again, is the reversal of roles. We have the midwife not there sent to take the baby out, but they're sent to put the baby in. Not the exorcist is not there sent to take the spirit out. It's there to put the spirit in, and that's necromancy from the darkness. Baby
guy. Wow.
And so Yahweh said the following in, oh, my God. In the literature, they called him the blood redeemer. And you know, I grew up in Christianity, so I always heard that the blood redeemer was, you know, he purchased us with his own blood, he hung on the cross, all that stuff. And that's true, but that's not, it's nowhere near the depth of what he did. The blood redeemer is one who actually you're related to. And if something happens to you, he takes it upon himself to avenge the blood guilt. You ready for this? This is going to change. Oh, my God. The other night, I wept like a baby because I understood the entire holy writ. We were not related to him. So he could not be our blood redeemer. So he purchased us with his own blood. Ooh. Now, he has the responsibility that he took upon himself to avenge the fallen. That is incredible.
Yes, it is.
Because he said, listen, see, guys, the priest could not touch the deceased. It didn't matter. And yet Paul said, we have not a high priest who cannot be touched by the feeling of our infirmities. Why did he do it? Why did he purchase us? Because he's saying essentially that there is going to be someone who will avenge, and it's going to be someone who plays by his own rules. This is interesting too. I was talking to a psychologist earlier today and just kind of rehashing some of these ideas. Yahweh looks at these people in Ezekiel 13 and he says, listen, I'm not going to pull, I'm not going to pull your spirit out like an exorcist. I'm going to pull the flesh off of your body and reveal your naked spirit before the world. You want to talk about judgment, Doc?
Right.
Holy smokes. That's the level he's playing at. Oh, my God.
Right?
Oh, Lord. It's just a fascinating subject.
It really is, Nathaniel.
Like you say, they're playing by different rules.
They are. And I'm telling you, there's one guy that you don't want to mess with. I mean, he doesn't. You want to talk about a cold stone killer. You're dealing with a god who said, listen, they don't have family. I'll just purchase them with my own blood. They have no one to fight for them. They have no one to be their advocate. The injustice, what did he say in Genesis? He said, the blood of your brother cries out to me. So it's
that is
thank you
awesome.
For having me. Thank you.
That's great.
Thank you. Thank you. We're coming to the close of our show. Mm-hmm. That was awesome. And that's a great note to leave on, because that is something to think about. This is deep. We appreciate you so much for coming on tonight.
We really do, Nathaniel.
And yeah, man, look forward to talking further.
Yes, sir. You guys are the best, man. Thank you.
Oh, wait.
Thank you. You are. Absolutely.
Absolutely. So just let our audience know. Stick around. We have Trip in the Voids coming up. And Dell from the Delicious Recipe on UPRN is turned 50. And we're going to do a little celebrating
yes,
for them.
You guys are.
You know, toast a glass, and we're gonna stick hang out with those guys, and so stick around. We're gonna get to that next week. We have Heidi Hollis coming on to talk about shadow people and Hat Man and old hag syndrome, and that'll be interesting, because we got our own stories about that, and
Heidi
certainly knows that in and out. She is the premier person for such things, so we're really psyched about that, and thank you again.
Yeah. Yes, thank you, Nathaniel. We appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon.
I really enjoyed this. I'm going to be excited for that. Yeah, thank you.
All right, man. I'll talk soon.
Yes, sir.
You have a great night, my friend.
You too. Thank you. God bless.
Thank our listeners.
You too.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Bigfoot
and the Bunny.
We'd like to thank Joe Montaldo for his engineering and support.
Thank you, Joe.
Be sure to look for us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter.
You can also find us at Dark Horse Paranormal and Purple Raven Paranormal by searching those very same outlets. You can email us at bigfootandthebunny@gmail.com. Thank you.
Catch you later.
Bye.